This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You ever feel like you really need to get something off your chest? This is like a real thing. Like, if you're mad, if you're upset, if there's something going on, like there's often for me an idea. Maybe it's a wrong. Maybe it's a moment. It's an injustice. It's something that just you keep going on and on, over and over in your mind about it, and like that can create anger and resentment or shame, whatever it is. And very often, I have found, I am not a therapist, I have found that when you let it out, when you give it voice, when you say it out loud, sometimes it makes you feel better because you've expressed it. And sometimes it makes you realize like, oh, this is not a big deal, but it's been stuck in my head. So you give voice to those things, and it can make you feel a lot better. And shock of all shocks, therapy is one of those things that can help you do that. It can help you be able to say those things in a place where you don't need to worry about the repercussions of it, work your way through it, figure out coping skills, how to get around it, you know, find ways to deal with that stuff instead of letting it fester. If you are thinking of starting therapy, if anything I said sounds familiar, you're like, oh, maybe my life would be a little better if I could deal with that kind of thing, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's fully online. It is convenient, flexible. It is suited to your schedule. That's the idea. That's what they're going for. You can fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. That's a big deal. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. That personal connection, I believe, to be super important. Again, I'm not a professional. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. You get 10% off your first month. That is BetterHelp, HELP.com/iFanboy.
You are listening to the iFanboy Pick of the Week podcast, episode 391, brought to you by iFanboy listeners just like you.
It's not that easy being green. Having to spend each day the color of the leaves. When I think it could be so much nicer being red, yellow, or gold, or something much more colorful like that.
Hello, welcome to the iFanboy Pick of the Week podcast, episode 391. My name is Connor Kilpatrick, and joining me is Paul Montgomery.
Hello.
And sitting in for a wayward Josh Flanagan is Dave Acampo.
Howdy.
Dave is the co-host with Paul of the Fuzzy Typewriter podcast, which makes me wonder who is guest starring on whose show.
This is exciting. I've been waiting for this to happen, and I'm so excited awesome. To have you on the show, man.
So Dave and Paul do the Fuzzy Typewriter podcast, and Dave also just did a series of articles for iFanboy chronicling his experience as a small indie publisher. So Dave also is a comic creator as well. So welcome to the show, Dave.
Well, thank you guys for having me.
And we are iFanboy.com. We like comics. We read comics. We could read a bunch of comics. This week, I read very few comics. One of us picks the best book, writes about it on the website. We talk about the podcast along with other books of the week and other topics of interest. It's lots of fun, assuming half the hosts aren't extremely tired. Before we get to the show, a quick reminder and a warning. This is a review show, so there'll be spoilers. And you'll find... did anything happen? Oh, yeah. Age of Ultron. We'll talk about that. There'll be spoilers, so if you haven't read the books, pause and come back later. You'll be much happier and much less excitable in your life. Everyone needs to calm down, is how I feel right now. It could be because I'm exhausted. This week, Paul had the pick. Take it away, Paul.
I did. And, you know, talking about, like, things happening and then, you know, there's other books that are more incidental. I kind of picked an incidental book this week, and very purposefully. Not that I was looking for something like that, but it just turned out that all this heady stuff with Infinity and everything and Uncanny Avengers, which I really enjoyed, but just really big concepts and everything. I chose Indestructible Hulk number 9, which is just sort of a buddy romp. And there's taxi surfing. There's, you know, like an almost barroom brawl that just turns into a singularity event. There's the Agence Byzantine, one of my favorite terrorist group.
Well, if you have to have one, they're the
at least in the Marvel universe, yeah. Maybe my favorite overall terrorist group. They're great. I think that's a Mark Waid invention.
Well, I think you're bearing the lead here, which is that this is Mark Waid's less celebrated book. He has Daredevil, which everybody loves. It won a bunch of Eisners last year.
I think anything else would just be, it would be, you know, the also-ran next to Daredevil, which is just...
In this issue, we have the start of a Daredevil-Hulk team-up story. It's not a crossover, as far as I can tell. It's not crossing over to Daredevil, mm-hmm. which is fine.
No.
It's just Daredevil shows up in Hulk. And so you've got Mark Waid writing his extremely popular character in this book that's also very good. We've picked it 2 times out of 9. It's tons of fun, and I think more people should be reading it.
Here's the question for you. Mm-hmm. When has Daredevil ever been the breath of fresh air for a book, you know? Like, because he's fun and fancy free in this book, and because compared to the Hulk, at least, he's happy-go-lucky. But it's not, you know, it's not all, you know, fun and games. They also have to track down this missing singularity gun.
Right.
That's been stolen from the ship. And this is all part of Hulk's work, Banner's work for S.H.I.E.L.D. Banner has agreed to be a field operative as the Hulk for Maria Hill. In return, he gets this amazing, lavish science lab where he can work on fixing his image, really. Like, he wants to do good, make good for humanity, and do all the things that, you know, Reed Richards and Tony Stark have done, except right. he's been sidelined by turning into a big green rage monster.
Yeah, he has a temper problem.
Yeah, he has a temper problem. So this
I like
is,
the way... You know, Mark Waid has shifted it in this series that, you know, he treats Hulk as a chronic condition. And so rather than wasting all his time, you know, forming the Hulkbuster, whatever, you know, trying to figure out how to separate himself from the Hulk, you know, it's just, what can I do in the meantime? And then I really like the way he brings Daredevil into this book, as you alluded to. There's almost a sense that he's sort of a sponsor. There's a thing like, hey, I'm going to be in your neighborhood, and I thought we could do a procedural spot check, I think is the term he uses. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So it's kind of like, we're going to check to see if you're too angry, if S.H.I.E.L.D.'s treating you well, if you can handle this. And I thought that was a very clever way. I think Mark Waid, more than probably most comic writers, has a great way of stripping down the characters to their core. But then beyond that, he figures out a way to create the situation that brings them both together, which is, you know, what you're talking about.
Yeah,
here.
it's not quite a character like deconstruction or anything like that, but
it's purification.
Yeah, but it's also surprising. Like, he's not breaking them down into like archetypes. It's like that. Like, I never would, and I don't know. Like, because I haven't read a lot of Hulk over the years. I don't know if there's a tradition of the Hulk teaming up with Daredevil or anything like that. But it feels so natural. But it's not something that I would have thought of right off the bat. Like, those two being friends.
Right.
But it makes sense. Hulk needs a lawyer. He creates a lot of property damage. So Matt Murdock would be able to help out. And Matt is a great listener. So he'd be able to get through all that and be able to talk the Hulk down, which he does in this issue. And I kind of thought that this issue maybe was heading towards the Hulk murdering. He almost murdered one of the bad guys, and Daredevil was, you know, over off to the side for a minute. And I thought, oh no, Daredevil's not going to be there to stop him. And now he's going to have to be like his, you know, his trial lawyer, like the Hulk murdered someone, and Daredevil has to step in. But luckily, it's a little different than that.
But within that, Paul, I think there's something really interesting in this issue, and I have a feeling it's going to play out next time, but you guys probably picked up on this too. Did you notice, like, there's a significant portion at the beginning where Daredevil calms the Hulk down, as you said,
yeah.
And he sort of says to Maria Hill, you know, well, he's just responding to the tone of voice. Mm-hmm. He, you know, Banner trusts me, so therefore, you know, this is cutting through that noise. So Mark Waid has a great ability to do this in some of these books, and he did it in Daredevil as well, where he gives us something that's really kind of nice, and then he takes it away. Because I got the sense, when Hulk faces down that sonic weapon that, mm-hmm. that Daredevil can't really face down, that he's going deaf. And there's a point at the end where he says, oh my God, the Hulk can't hear me. And I thought, wow, what a great place to put your characters as a writer. Like, yeah. You had one way to calm the Hulk down, which was a tone of voice. Now we're going to remove that from the equation. What do you do? And so I have a feeling that's going to play out in a really interesting way. And so, you know, I think this builds really nicely. I'm very curious to see where it goes.
And ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, Matteo Scalera on art.
You missed out on him when he did Secret Avengers towards the end of Remender's run, which was the first time I think I remember noticing him and going, oh, wow.
Yeah, I was a little scattered after Gabe left that book, but then Gabriel Hardman. But I've seen him a lot in our, you know, best panels and our weekly SketchUp feature, and he's just amazing and a really great fit for both the Hulk and Daredevil. He's able to capture.
He'd be fine staying on this book. He would be.
Yeah.
He has a great sense of energy and dynamism, which you need for
exactly.
the Hulk. Obviously, you know, there's a couple of great. He also does movement very well. Mm-hmm. Looking at the taxi surfing scene,
yeah.
And you get a sense of movement in a static image, which is sometimes difficult. It's a car coming at you, and it's just Hulk is about big action and movement, and that you need an artist who can convey that. He does a lot of circular panels within the square panel, sort of circular way that panels are laid out within the square, you know, boxes, and mm-hmm. really, especially with a sonic gun and things like that. But it really does. create the sense of dynamic movement, which you need and is wonderful.
Does a great Hell's Kitchen. That's really nice. I don't know if it, you know, reflects modern Clinton, but no. It looks like Marvel Hell's Kitchen.
Marvel Hell's Kitchen is stuck in the 80s forever.
Which is fine. That's sort of the way it should be. But no, that's fantastic. And then that page that we ran in Best Panels this week where the Hulk comes in to the bar behind Daredevil. And Daredevil, you know, he eases on in this bar. He's set up before he goes in that these guys are just going to pull their weapons on me and shoot as soon as I go in. But he walks in casually because he knows that he's got a Hulk behind him. And it's a fantastic
page.
Great
storytelling, yeah.
And, you know, that's one thing to write that, but I think, you know, Sclera really pulls it off in the art. It's really funny. It's, you know, it's tense, too. It's great.
It reminds me a bit of Sean Murphy. Did you guys get that vibe?
Absolutely. He did a sketch of the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, and we ran that in SketchUp, and I thought it was Sean Murphy, and I was like, whoa, who's this guy? But yeah, I kind of liken him. He's a little bit like Sean Murphy, a little bit like Declan Shalvey, and then, you know, does his own thing too. So really, really strong.
And if you're a Baron Zemo fan, there's a great final page reveal of the villain of the story.
Ooh. Somebody pointed out on the comics page for this book that, like, he's drinking wine, and, like, he's got his mask down. So is he lifting his mask every time he drinks the wine? I thought that was kind of funny.
He's got a little, like, straw hole in the mask.
Yeah, the little juice box, you know?
The mask is very strange.
But that totally works for Baron Zemo, you know? So I'm thrilled. I'm excited to see Wade take on Baron Zemo. It's going to be great.
Wonder Woman 21 this week. I really enjoy this book, but I think when Cliff Chang is on it, it's really when it elevates ire. And also, I love the idea that they're integrating into the God and Myth storyline, the New Gods. We've had Orion for a while, and there's been New God stuff throughout some of the other books, but for now, they're really going for it now. I mean, this issue ends with the Boom Tube trip to
New Genesis.
New Genesis and meeting Highfather. So, you know, it's a great juxtaposition of the old Greek gods and the new gods, and the new gods are supposed to replace the old gods, in the story, in the general sort of mythology of this universe anyway. So it's nice to see them sort of run up against each other. I don't think I've seen that before, ever.
Yeah, this is the thread that I've sort of been clinging on to in this book because I'm getting a little fatigued with the Greek pantheon stuff. Mm-hmm. There's really interesting ideas, but it's sort of lost a little bit of its luster for me. I'm just not as invested in those characters, but I really love the depiction of Wonder Woman. I love Orion too, you know, and calling her legs throughout this issue. And just the banter between them was really great.
Has he ever called his little rocket thing that he rides around on baby before this?
I can't imagine.
That was kind of interesting. And she thinks he's calling her babies on your legs.
Your legs, yeah.
Making it a very deliberate nickname, you know?
That's, you usually think of Orion being like so, you know, ultra serious.
Right.
And, you know, I think this is fun.
He's more brash.
Yeah.
I agree with you, Paul, in that a little bit of this lost its luster in that I think the first year of the book was really strong in sort of engaging us in this new variation on the Greek pantheon. And then I think that's what we're getting is that slow buildup to the new gods clashing with the old. And so that's where it's starting to become more fun the more we interact with them. Highfather was a little bit different than I expected. I'm used to the kind of the shepherd's crook kind of Highfather.
Right.
The guy's a little more militaristic.
I don't know what it looks like. It looks a little bit like New Krypton or something, the New Genesis. But it's only we only saw like one page, right? One angle.
Yeah.
So I'm excited for the next issue to see more in New Genesis because I love that stuff.
Do you guys feel like Cliff Chang's artwork is changing at all? I felt, and I'm reading it digitally now, so maybe I'm focusing more on the art, but I felt like in some panels it's a little rougher, but there's something, and maybe it's the way it's constructed, almost Kyle Baker-y. Like, I don't know. I felt like it's changing a little bit, and I like it in a good way, I should say.
I think it's different than when we first sort of broke out on Green Arrow. He has gotten a little rougher style, a little less clean, but it's still, you know, undeniably Cliff Chang, which is wonderful.
Yeah.
He does great. There's a panel again for the Best Panels feature where Wonder Woman grabs a guy, flips him over, and crashes into his, you know, down in his head, and it was just a wonderful, you know, three-piece action sequence in one panel. He does a really great job with that stuff.
Yeah.
I can see the Kyle Baker thing. I don't know where that started though. You know, I don't know if that's always been there and just, you know, got augmented over time or what, but. I definitely see your point. Uncanny Avengers number 9. Lots of stuff going on. And Remender kind of talking to us a bit.
There's a lot of debate in this book, right?
Two different places. And Connor mentioned this to me on instant message, though. It looks like there's a little fourth wall breaking in Uncanny Avengers. And I thought it was just the Wonder Man scene. where he turns to us and sort of gives a wink. Yeah. But then later on, there's a bit of a confrontation between Rogue and Scarlet Witch, and a little bit of the conversation going on online a few months back.
Well, for one thing, he uses the Game of Thrones method of dropping the exposition in the middle of something very exciting happening. So there's
sexposition in Game of Thrones.
It's not exactly sexposition, but it's basically Danger Room, this position where they're in there fighting, and it's so
climactic in a different way.
They're not just standing around the conference table debating; they're fighting this classic Spider-Man villain, which I loved in the Danger Room.
Yeah.
If you were in the Danger Room, you would fight whoever the hell you wanted to fight. You don't have to fight your villains. You can decide today we're going to fight Spider-Man's villains.
Right.
But Remender caught a lot of flack for his Havoc speech, where he said, "I'm a person first and a mutant second," and this seems to be sort of his rebuttal to that, which I've always been a supporter of that scene, and I thought it was a great moment. I think his rebuttal makes a lot of sense.
I got what he was saying in that instance, but I was like, whoa, people are going to react to this. I could tell just reading it, because it's such a such a bald statement coming from a beloved character, and mutants is kind of a touchy thing, talking about persecution, and
they don't seem to be reacting to this as much as they did the original statement, which says a lot about the nuanced response doesn't get quite the play as the polemic, but that's just what happens.
Do you think those people just like dropped it? Like,
I just think when you explain yourself, you don't tend to get the play you do when you.
Yeah, very true.
Mm-hmm. But I'm kind of not tired of it, but there's a lot of Captain America Wolverine clashing going on in all the books they appear in.
Which
is getting kind of repetitive a little bit, but I do like the fact that Wolverine is basically, the chickens are coming home the roost from the Uncanny X-Force storyline in which he killed Kid Apocalypse. So I like that thread's continuing on.
Yeah, there's definitely a through line from the Remender stuff from, like you said, from Uncanny X-Force. And I like that. I think I like a lot of what they're building to, and I like that there's this schism between the team. It is sort of a team forced together. I felt like this issue, there's just a lot of exposition. Like you said, it's set in really nice locations, but you start with, I think, a kind of nice conversation. I actually like the relationship between Wonder Man and Wolverine. I kind of want to see more of pacifist at Hollywood Simon Williams. I want him to have like a raw food diet and kind of just like completely opposite of Logan, right? I can see a buddy comedy with the two of those.
Although that totally steak was pretty raw that he was eating. Wolverine was eating.
It was like, whoa, what cut is that?
It's really
but that's
bloody.
Wolverine, right?
Like, he just sheared that off like outside on the grounds. Like they have some, something roaming around out there.
But for me, then you got into the villains sort of explaining a lot of their plan, and that's a pretty dense. I mean, it's again really interesting to look at. I love the character designs, but it's pretty dense. And then you get more of the debate. And I do appreciate that it's the schism between these two groups. It kind of reminds me of what we're seeing on the current season of Mad Men, where you have two groups of people from different companies put together into one company, and sort of the they have to figure out how to work together. Yeah. And I they need to sort of figure out a way to resolve that soon, and really build up the action and the dramatic tension and stuff, because this starts to,
given that the conflict is so like just kind of really cerebral ideas and like really kind of abstract stuff with the Apocalypse twins and everything, so it's kind of a lot in one issue. And if it was spread out a little bit more, maybe. Yeah, I don't know though. But it's beautiful. It's still beautiful.
Is the return of the century akin to the return of Duck Phillips?
I don't know if anything is akin to the return of Duck Phillips. That's always a pleasure.
So we end with the Four Horsemen of Death returning as the Apocalypse's acolytes, and we have got the Century, and we have Dokken, and we have Banshee, and we have the Wonder Man's brother's name I always forget. So it'll be fun to see them get beat up again and killed.
What the hell is that guy's name?
I always forget.
It's like Harpoon or something.
No, it's not.
Something like
Reaper?
That.
Something like that, yeah. Ultimate Comics Spider-Man 24, Cloak and Dagger make their ultimate debut, and I really like Dave Marquez a lot in this book.
Yes,
in the beginning, absolutely. I was always sad when Sarah Pichelli didn't draw it, and he did, even though he's a good artist, but now I really feel like he can just stay on the book.
I like Marquez wherever he goes. He can do whatever he wants. He's like the guy that you're never disappointed to see that he's the fill-in, and you don't think about it. It's just a great looking comic. So we got a really quick, really succinct origin story for Cloak and Dagger, which is pretty cool. I kind of like how that is told. It's simple enough. We get it all in one issue, and we get parallel action to what's going on at the restaurant.
And Arnim Zola's sweet hair.
Yeah.
It's, that was great. It's pretty sweet.
Forgot about that.
It's like a giant mushroom on his head.
It's got this like Phil Spector thing going on. I don't know.
Crazy wig Phil Spector look.
Yeah. Not enough Miles' dad in this issue for my liking.
Yeah.
Need some more Miles' dad. He's great. Fantastic character. And we got a great moment with Gwen slapping Miles in the face for not being a hero when he could be.
That was great.
It's all about great responsibility. And I really do love this thing that Bendis is able to do where you have a new Spider-Man, but he's not the only Spider-Man that there's ever been. There is a precedent. And all of this stuff is like pressure put upon him. And so he doesn't just have to live up to these great powers or, you know, the ghost of Uncle Ben or anything. He's got to live up to like the ghost of Uncle Ben by way of the ghost of Peter Parker.
Right.
And all his living friends. Yeah. A lot of ghosts, you know, a lot of skeletons.
And that was, and it's similar to, you know, Peter and Uncle Ben, you know, that driving him into action, you know, the ghost of Peter sort of drives him into action, but then the death of his mother is really what's shaken him to the core. And that's sort of, you know, that's the sort of thing that we're dealing with right now is, okay, you know, with great power comes great responsibility, but look at when people are dying around you, can you really overcome that? And he's really pressing on that conflict. And I like, you're really illustrating it by having other heroes and villains battling around you and sort of like, you know, are you going to put it on? Are you going to put on the costume? It's a great conflict. You know, you can do it. You know, what stops you from doing it? And, you know, I think that's really smart. I like the way they're carrying forward Miles' conflict.
And the most important thing is he's just not Peter Parker. You know, he's a different guy. He doesn't jump right into the adventure of it like Peter did. Even if Peter was terrified, you know, he covered that with his jokes, but he still did it. You know, Miles is still sort of feeling this out, and it's an interesting dynamic to play. You know, and we'll talk about the possible future of this book later in the show, but it's interesting while it's happening.
So Animal Man 21.
I feel like Animal Man's bounced back in the last three issues.
Yeah.
I agree.
Since Rot World.
I was almost going to drop this book. I actually was ready. This was going to be the one that I wasn't going to pick up, but I was hearing interesting things, and so I picked it up, and I'm actually glad I did. I liked it.
It's got the social media, got the Twitter.
Well, let's talk about Twitter for a second. This is the first time I've seen it used successfully in a book. I think the last time I saw it used this much was in that Joe Casey Japanese Heroes book, which was... He didn't use it correctly because he just doesn't use Twitter, whereas Jeff Lemire does, and so he really sort of gets the bizarre banality of it.
Yeah. I would say the only comparable thing would be when they riffed on Tumblr in Young Avengers, the current run.
This is throughout the story. It sort of adds to the idea that he's this superhero celebrity actor who people on Twitter were obsessed with, and so sort of narrating his adventures, the rumors that are completely false, and the speculations, and the twit pics, and I really sort of captured the current zeitgeist of how it's used with celebrity.
Absolutely, it really impacts the story, right? I mean, because what happens is he decides, okay, he's wallowing in, you know, his grief and everything, and his agent's trying to get him back, and he you know, to go to an award show or something
typical
like that.
Typical agent,
right?
trying to capitalize on the heat around Animal Man,
and yet he's like,
kid.
And so he decides, I got to go do some superheroing. And so in doing so, he takes flight into Los Angeles and immediately Twitter lights up. And you imagine that that's how it does happen. I mean, we've seen that in our modern society. When something happens, it ripples across Twitter. And so you have people following. And I love it. There's like, oh, they're just filming a movie. Oh, no, he's actually back in action, you know. and it actually impacts the story because people are tracking him and they're wondering what's going on. And so when he actually walks out of the place he's in, the warehouse where he's tracking down some missing animals, you know, there's all sorts of reporters and everybody waiting because that's the way media works now. So you've got this whole thing of like, can you even be a superhero if you've got people following you around and snapping, you know, Instagram or twit pics or whatever, you know? Although I will say, I love that what brings him back into action is he decides that he's going to save some missing cats.
I mean, he's the animal activist. There's a lot of things that are really interesting and unique about Animal Man that really got lost in Rot World. Just because it was so encompassing, we sort of lost his story. And now with this one and the previous two issues, we're back in it, and it's really interesting. This is what people loved in the first couple of issues of the series. He's a great, unique character.
Thinking back on that first page of Animal Man number one in the New 52, I mean, this is going back there. Yeah, I think it's really just the Rot World stuff just like got
there
in
are
the
unique
way.
Conflicts to Animal Man that don't exist with other heroes in the way they're written.
Yeah.
And even though, you know, in reality, everybody would be following everybody on Twitter in the superhero world. But anyway, there's unique elements to this story and this the way it's done that make it really fun when they stick to them. And I'm really back into this book a lot now. So I really like the last three issues. So if you want to go back and you want to check out Animal Man, you can go to ifanboy.com/Amazon to go there, and you can pick up the first trade or the second trade if you really want to be complete about it. And it helps us out, helps the website keep going, helps us keep the lights on, helps pay the bills, and we get a little piece of your transaction. It doesn't come out of your pocket, it comes out of Amazon's pocket, which, if you know, is very, very, very deep.
You can pre-order the Grant Morrison Animal Man omnibus, yes, coming out later this summer.
Great series. One of the
Do
best.
That. Plus more money for us,
plus
which is
George
all that
George Foreman grills. We always like to push the George Foreman grill.
Not, George Foreman
not
grills,
not really
man.
A piece of that, but we do think it's fun.
Indoor, outdoor, George Foreman. You can use a George Foreman grill outside
this
and then
I
bring it back inside.
All I fan by Christmas bonuses will be in the form of George Foreman grills.
Does he have a panini press? I think
he
should.
Not he should. They
press.
Should really
Those
be
are huge.
At the brand and moving out, branching out to panini presses and all kind. All,
waffle
any,
irons.
Anything you can press on a counter in your kitchen, waffle irons. Should really be in the line, but we'll get on that. We'll talk to somebody. We'll send an email out. In the meantime, Captain Marvel 13.
My love affair continues with this book, Captain Marvel number 13. Dave, did you read this one?
I did. I actually picked up the entire Enemy Within storyline so that I could kind of catch up.
Is that the first volume or the second volume?
So here's the story. Actually, my girlfriend and I were talking about female superheroes the other day, and we realized that, you know, she didn't really know a lot of the female superheroes out there. So we went into the comic book store and we picked up volume 1 and 2 of Captain Marvel.
Okay.
We're still reading those. So I haven't read all of that stuff, but because I knew that you wanted to talk about this today, I picked up the Enemy Within storyline and sort of jumped ahead a little bit. And so this is just the Avengers Assemble Captain Marvel crossover book right now, this current storyline.
Yeah, you're bringing in the Avengers. And there's, you know, the Brood are involved, and there's some Kree sentries waking up. Yeah, the Brood, scary. There's xenomorphs, man.
Who is the artist on this?
They're the aliens. This is Scott Hepburn. It looks a lot like Tom Fowler to me.
It does look a bit like Tom Fowler. It reminds me a little bit of Ramon Perez. I don't think it's quite as strong as either of those guys. I feel like there's a little inconsistency here and there, but this is a person I think to watch.
And again, it's just like this book. I mean, it started off a little bit rough art wise, but like, you know, coming with Felipe Andrade and then this guy, it just looks different. And yeah. it has great voice. She has a great cast of friends, and it's a lot of fun. It's really refreshing, and it picks up the torch for me from Brian Q. Miller's Batgirl, and before that, Palmiotti and Gray's
Power Girl.
Yeah. So I definitely recommend you pick up these books, especially volume 2 of this. I think you'd start there and it'd be good. Tell us about Revival number 11, Dave.
I'm still reading this book. I kind of flirted with, you know, is the story going anywhere? But it's kind of, I think it's getting to a place where the setting is now kind of taking hold in that.
It's sort of like a Twin Peaks thing, isn't it? I mean, it's sort
exactly.
of like that. You're a big
it
Twin
is.
Peaks
I've
guy.
I've just been watching Twin Peaks again, nice. You know, as Connor knows, the importance of rewatching Twin Peaks on a regular basis. And it really was striking me as I was reading this issue, how similar it is in that you do have a town where something strange has happened. In this case, these dead people have come back. And it was kind of bothering me a little bit. In the beginning, this was subtitled a rural noir, and noir is such a loaded term, and I'm like, is it really? This doesn't feel so noir to me. But now we're getting to a point where you've got like a group of brothers who are who have decided that the reviver body parts are very valuable. They're like, I think he calls them like tiger penises or something like that. And this, you know, he's like they're the kind of exotic delicacy that people need for whatever reason. And so they've hatched this scheme to like basically chop up these people and sell their body parts across state lines. And so now I'm getting the noir vibe. I think it's a big ensemble cast, and sometimes it gets a little confused. But I think, you know, as the characters sort of interact and move around with each other, it's getting more interesting. But I'm definitely.
Is there a central narrative to this, or is it just these characters in this town?
It feels like there's this police officer that's sort of the center, but and her sister. There's Dana Cypress and her sister M, who was killed early on and is now one of these revived people. It seems to focus on the two of them. M is the one that wears the sort of sewn together hoodie with the angel wings on the back. If you guys have seen that image, it's a lot of the cover images. It seems to be centering around them, but it is very much an ensemble cast. I mean, in the fact that like Twin Peaks does seem to center on Dale and Sheriff Truman, but it spends almost as much time on, you know, like Big Ed and, you know, like the different characters around Twin Peaks. It feels a lot like
that. It's the Twin Peaks Northern Exposure kind of vibe to it, the weirdness.
It does,
of the So, all right. I know, Connor, you're a big fan of the volleyball book.
This is the sports book.
This is the sports book. That's what we always say whenever we mention Mara. Mara number 5 by Brian Wood, Ming Doyle, and Jordy Belair on colors. Jordy Belair, big part of this book. I mean, she always brings something with the colors, but with this book in particular, I mean, there's this page with the striking orange that comes out, and it's a really kind of a minimalistic look to this book. And this is a really interesting story, especially coming away from Man of Steel, because it's about this girl who has these powers, basically becoming like a Superman or like a Dr. Manhattan with, you know, like a just godlike. And her brother is tortured to death because they're trying to figure out if he might have some of those powers as well. And the whole idea with this book is that the government in this near-ish future kind of world wants to use Mara as a pawn in their negotiations with, you know, other countries. Basically, their trump card. And they would bring her out and say, like, you know, we're going to – she's our WMD, you know, and the other countries would back down. This is where Mara decides she actually renounces her citizenship, not just from America like Superman once did, but from humanity. And then she sends missiles against the Earth.
You know, it's a fun take on the Superman myth kind of idea, like you just laid out. I mean, and I think that was really interesting to me that's where this the pivot point at the end of this book. I guess my only question now, looking back on it, goes back to that sports book idea. Not that I can get that she's a volleyball star or whatever before she gets her powers, but does it seem strange to you at all, Paul, that this is a book set in like a near future? Like, I don't understand the point of setting it in the near future or into some kind of sci-fi-ish future, because it doesn't relate to how she gets her powers or anything.
You know, that's a good point. I mean, other than just it's just an interesting setting, it seems like at odds with the idea of we're going to make her – she's going to be, you know, an athlete. It's sort of like you have two different kind of kernels for doing a superhero story differently. And one is she's a sports star and one is it's in the near future. And like, it's just.
It could also be that setting a story in the near future gives you more freedom to stretch things in the future, should you want to, in terms of technology.
And I mean, I'm not, you know, and it's just. It's
also
just
the idea that volleyball is popular could be something
I love watching volleyball during the
Olympics. You have to set it in the near future.
I do as well.
It's a really fun. I mean, either, you know, beach volleyball or indoor volleyball.
Listen, I love it. For indoor, I'm just saying, I really enjoy that everyone is mad that this wasn't a sports book. I still love it.
Yeah, we're not getting so many of those comments anymore, but like it used to be every single month they'd come out and be like, there's not enough sports. I thought it was supposed to be. I thought it was going to be like the Matt Christopher books or something. I don't know. That was when I was in grade school.
Is there sports in the Sixth Gun?
Maybe.
No?
The Sixth Gun, yes. I was going to say maybe the finale of this involves Ingrid, another volleyball player, swatting the missiles away like a volleyball. I don't know. It all comes into play. Sixth Gun number 32, for me, I have liked this book for a long time. What I really liked about it, what clicked for me around the second volume of the series was that we started to just use all the different sort of old mythologies and religions and folklore, you know, that was prevalent in the Old West and some even today. And you got to see it play out. So you got like a voodoo series. And more recently, we've gone into sort of Native American rituals with ghost dancing. And this book has always been sort of like a supernatural Western. It's very much like felt like the structure of like a fantasy book, you know, like a Middle Earth type of Lord of the Rings, but with guns because it's the Old West. And here you get, in this issue, we get the connection between, you know, the fantasy past and, you know, the Old West current, where we see, you know, in medieval times, they would have been six swords. You know, they're just guns because it's the Old West. But I continue to really enjoy this book.
It's like Valyrian steel or something. I don't know. It's just like there's this lore to it. So Demeter,
yes.
The third in the Ink and Thunder series, which includes Wolves in the Mire from Becky Cloonan. She wrote and drew these. This was available in Comixology this week. This is kind of, you know, she's doing these cool stories that what was Wolves was about, like werewolves, but in a different sort of way, in sort of like a fantasy setting.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, I guess, is about like a witch.
Yeah, she's doing these sort of lush fairy tales. And I guess
I only half got it.
Really?
To be honest, I didn't entirely follow the twist.
I think there's a lot of atmosphere in this, and you know, I think it is very much, I think, one of those fairy tales where it's like, you lost him to the sea, but I gave him back to you, but really he's still mine, and, you know, it's going to cost you. There's a thing where she's putting every year she has to put like drops of her blood into the ocean.
Right.
You know, it's like that monkey's paw kind of idea too. Yeah. Where it's like, you know, you wish for them to come back, you'll sacrifice anything, you'll make that sort of Faustian deal, and you know, they'll never be completely yours. Again, you know, and the sea is always calling. And so it's definitely a lot of atmosphere. I like it in that her tone in these reminds me a bit of like when she and Brian Wood did Demo, kind of crossed with what she did with Brian Wood with Conan. You know, it's sort of that medieval fantasy fairy tale setting. But I love that this is a 99-cent book that you can get digitally, and it's a complete, it feels to me like a very robust tale, like as solid as anything else you'd get from any of the major companies. So I really enjoyed this a lot.
Yeah, it's really nice looking. It's you know, kind of, it's a bit melodramatic. It's like a bit Anne Rice fairy tale kind of thing, you know?
A little bit
like that, but...
But I think it's fitting for the fairy tale nature of it. I don't know.
But yeah, very spooky, very evocative. I really liked Wolves. I prefer that one over this, but really good stuff.
Yeah.
So those are the books we're going to talk about this week. As you may have gathered, I've read very little books this week. Go to fanboy.com/comics. You can make your own pull list. You can rate and review your books, and you can also choose your own pick of the week. And we like to run down the top five picks of the week as chosen by the audience at the time of recording. And the top five books are thus. Number five, The X-Files Season 10, number one, with 9.6% of the votes. Number four was Indestructible Hulk, number nine, 14.7% of the votes. Number three, Liberator, number one, with 14.8% of the votes, just eking out past Incredible Hulk. Number two, Uncanny Avengers, number nine, 20.3%. And number one, Wonder Woman 21, with 23.3%. A nice, pretty even spread there amongst the top five in terms of votes.
How cool is it to see? I mean, like the top polled books this week were mostly like Avengers stuff. It was like Age of Ultron and three Avengers books. How cool is it to see?
No. Uncanny Avengers was the top pulled book.
Yeah, but that has Avengers in the name.
Yeah, but not so Age of Ultron. Age of Ultron is not the top pulled book.
I didn't say it was one of them.
Listen,
it's Age
Paul,
of Ultron and three Avengers books.
Give me this moment.
I'm just saying it's cool to see Wonder Woman at the number one spot.
I just had no idea that there was a new X-Files book. And is this actually a new season? Is that what they're
from IDW? Isn't it by Chris Carter?
Chris Carter
is it?
Plotting it. Oh, wow. With another,
okay.
You know,
wow.
He's
I didn't even realize.
It like Joss Whedon does with his Buffy books.
Got it. That's the new thing.
I read an X-Files novel.
Only 10 years after the season show ended, or whatever that show ended.
What if we did a new Twin Peaks season in comics?
I don't want that.
I don't think I do.
Let's
either.
Read a couple of user reviews. We're going to do something different this time. We're going to present opposing opinions on one book with these user reviews. So, Dave, take away the first one.
All right. So this is from, well, it's either from a guy named Levi Takis, or maybe it's like Leviticus. But it's spelled like if he was born in Jack.
Levitakis, I think. I think we just summoned something.
Anyway, so of Age of Ultron number 10, he gives the story a 1 out of 5, the art a 3 out of 5, and his review is, wow, it takes a lot to offend me in comics, but this is close to number 1. I'll keep my review brief. All 9 issues before this did not matter. The only things that matter are the ramifications, the last 5 or so pages. Slight spoilers without any actual spoilers. A time loop is closed that keeps everything you've read from happening mattering. Then something matters that actually happens. Can I get a time loop to go back and keep my past self from wasting $40?
And the pick of the week percentage of this book is 0.1.
Okay, yeah, sorry about that.
That's all right.
Always forget something. Okay, so BC1 says of Age of Ultron, which he gave a 4 out of 5 for story and 5 out of 5 for art. So a little bit different. Pretty much plays out as we expected to a point. Yes, everything is fixed and the method makes logical sense in the context of the story, but it seems that there's been one trip through the time stream or across the dimensional barriers too many. Just a few things that you'll see. House of M, Killraven, Squadron Supreme, 2099, Spider-Girl, Avengers Next, and events from All New X-Men and Uncanny Avengers. There's another one, but I'll let readers see that one for themselves. It's Angela he's talking about.
No, it's Ultimate Spider-Man.
Oh, all right. Okay, you'll either love it or hate it. Overall, a good end to the series and an interesting setup for the future. And even if his page makes no sense, it's always good to see Quesada back at the drawing table again. If you want to see how the series ends, I'd check it out, but it's not a must-have comic by any means. Yeah, I guess that makes more sense than it would be. The thing is, I just thought that was kind of arbitrary, Galactus meeting Miles Morales.
Well, because... let's talk about the big twist. I mean, Paul and I think we... we talked about in the show, we both read the first couple of issues. We quickly dropped off because it was clearly not a compelling story for us. Mm-hmm. But I heard this, you know, the big things were happening in this issue. So I read this one and Paul did as well. And the big thing that happened in this issue was that, as BC1 said, that there's one too many trips to the time stream. It's broken the time stream. So all these different Marvel realities are sort of crossing over. And that's how the story ends. With mm-hmm. You've got Galactus from the Marvel Universe showing up in the Ultimate Universe against Miles Morales. You've got the 2099 Spider-Man. You've got Squadron Supreme. You've got all these different strands sort of connecting, the ramifications of which we don't know. The big twist, which they spoiled 3 months ago, was that Angela shows up at the end, who isn't even really from a Marvel Universe, but whatever. So she shows up at the end.
She's pissed. She does not want to be there.
So it's interesting. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of rumors that this is going to signal the end of the Ultimate line, which...
Right.
I don't know why you would do that if the books make money, but people are saying they're going to fold the characters into the Marvel Universe and have them be there as well, and that seems weird to me also, but at this point, anything's possible.
There is something weird with this, and that I don't know if you guys felt this at all, but for me, kind of pre-crisis DC multiverse, you always felt like they were, you know, these other Earth 1, Earth 2, all these different Earths, they were each their own equal thing, maybe because, you know, the way they were created. With Marvel, I always felt like that the alternate worlds were always kind of in service to the story. For the most part, in the old days, you know, and so even if you had like a, you know, the terminology of a 616 or whatever, that was just because you're telling a Captain Britain story about all these alternate Earths. And so even when like the Ultimate books came out, I felt like, okay, everyone was thinking like, is this going to be like a multiverse kind of thing? But it seemed like marketing wise, they were really trying to keep it separate. Now I feel like they're kind of... Do you feel like this is a shift into sort of a Marvel multiverse where they can have these multiple Earths, sort of a pre-crisis DC universe?
Well, they opened the door to that with the Spider-Man book.
Right. Well, yeah. That too. Yeah, right. But this seems to be like the big cement of like, okay, now we're going to keep crossing over. It's not just a one-off thing.
It's like the reverse crisis where they, you know, crisis closed the loop and this opened the loop.
That's what I mean. Is this
Isn't the weird thing with this that it was like they felt it was murky with all the different worlds and stuff, and now it's murkier? Like, like, because everything's all mixed up and stuff. It's just, it's odd. And the problem with this book is that, like, walking away from it, all people are talking about and all I'm thinking about is how it ended in terms of what are they going to do publishing-wise and what's going to happen with these, you know, the continuity. And it's not a story ending. It's, you know.
Yeah, and that's the kind of thing that always.
A publishing catalog.
When the series seems like it's all set up to just change the status quo, that bugs me. And it sounds like this story itself was not compelling on its own, which is a problem.
And I just don't see Marvel's having such success right now. I don't really see them blowing up their status quo. I just really can't see it. You know, all those Marvel Now books are so successful, you know, money wise and story wise. You know, they're clearly the best books being put out right now in aggregate. I just really can't see them blowing up and dropping Miles Morales into the Spider-Man's Superior Spider-Man world. I can't see it. It could happen. Right. I would not be surprised, but I also would be a little surprised.
I just wouldn't be surprised if there's more of like just crossing over between more often, you know, like the way the Justice League and Justice Society used to meet every year or whatever. I wonder if they're going to end up doing something like that.
The thing you described is, you know, they're separate worlds, but they are also the same world, you know?
Yeah.
Like there's Earth 1 and Earth 2, but they exist together and they're constantly crossing over. Whereas Ultimate Universe and Marvel Universe and 2099 Universe and all these different other worlds are ostensibly part of the Marvel Universe multiverse, which exists, but they don't ever really interact. So they feel separate.
Right. They didn't.
They forgot two pages in this book. At the end of it, it should have been an all black, you know, page with just a little slit of light looking through in an eye and a gasp, and then the next page, and it's Wanda Maximoff holding her closet door shut because what she's just seen. That's what's in the closet.
Perfect.
Nice.
Perfect.
Nice.
So you go to fanboy.com/comics. You can make your own pull list. You can rate and review books. And if you write a good review, we get it on the show. Let's do a couple of audience questions. The first one comes from Damien from Parts Unknown. And Damien writes and says, I got the Marvel character guide as a Saturnalia present. What is that?
This is an old email.
I have not gotten my Saturnalia presents lately, by the way.
And I'm flipping through it, nerding out over the semi-arbitrary numerical rankings for whom is stronger than whom and so forth. No way is Hawkeye just as smart as the Beast. Does that say that? That's crazy.
Wow.
I got thinking
He's
about...
He's got street smarts.
That's true. I got thinking about canon a bit. I was wondering about what writers' takes on characters you might like or dislike most because how much a change of pace they were from the conventional canonical take on the character. So who's... whose versions of a character have you disliked because it's such a different version?
Well, if we can count modern blockbuster films, I know Paul's
like.
Answer.
You could say like. my answer is everyone writing Superman right now, up to and including David Goyer.
Right.
Is Jeff Parker?
No, that's not. That book's fine, but the other
okay.
Book.
I thought it was really weird when Frank Miller did his Tintin book. I was just not feeling it whatsoever.
I think the one right now that's most the biggest one is Hawkeye. I think that Fraction's Hawkeye has been so different from the Hawkeye we've seen before that it's really worked.
Yeah, that's an example where it really works. Yeah. I remember historically, I'm going to date myself here, but like as a kid, when Longshot, the Ann Nesenti Art Adams series came out, I thought that was the coolest character. Then I remember Chris Claremont bringing him into X-Men, you know, in like the late 80s. And I'm like, oh, this is so cool. I can't wait. I love that character. And I felt like he never got the voice right. For me, it's not like canon stuff. It's like tone and voice. You know what I mean?
Separating between the version being different and just the writing being bad.
Well, okay, that could be a point too. You
know, well, okay, that, so for
because that could,
for one,
that could result in their tone being different. You know?
For one that I really like, you know, like Brubaker and Darwyn Cook on Catwoman.
Right.
Like, there's other Catwoman stories are not necessarily like that.
Wow.
They might retain afterwards. They might retain some of that character, some of that flair, but it just doesn't feel the same. It's not that same aesthetic, and you know, it's like filmic almost. I'm not talking about like widescreen things. I'm talking about like, it's, you know, it's like an old Rat Pack movie. You know?
Right. Cinematic. Right.
Similar to me, because I cut my teeth on the Denny O'Neill, the question, I think Greg Rucka is the only other person that's been able to write a question that evoked that same feeling that I got from that one. I haven't liked any other takes on it because that was the first one. So, you know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I tend to think of more of the versions I've liked that are different.
Right.
It's tough.
That's how we cope.
I think that, you know, often you get that in team books where you get a very specific voice in it for a character in a solo book, and then they show up in a team book and they just, it's different. They're not, you know, Wonder Woman in her solo book is very different from Wonder Woman in Justice League. And that's just always the way it's, when I read Justice League, you know, the Giffen McGuire era, those versions of the characters were different than their solo versions. Very different.
Batman was
it's not anything like the one that appeared in Detective Comics. That's just the way it goes. So
this is somehow we're okay with it.
this is a smaller example, but like you know, that I posted on the site that cover image of the most recent Superboy with Crypto on it. Crypto. And it looks like, I don't know what, like a feral, you know, there's like a saber-toothed tiger kind of thing. And then side by side with what Francis Manipal and Jeff Johns were doing on Adventure Comics. That's a, you know, it's not just a stylistic difference. It's a, you know, a temperament.
You could say a lot of the new 52 characterizations would fall in this category of disliking the change.
Yeah.
Let's move on to Andy from Cincinnati, who says, I have a very simple question. Why is it so difficult to tell good Superman stories?
Oh, boy.
Andy from Cincinnati is wrong and right at the same time. I don't think it's difficult. I think the weight of the icon is the difficult part of it. I think that's the problem.
I agree.
You know what I mean? He's Superman. He's the first superhero. Yeah. He's the face of a company. He's the face of DC Comics. And even if Batman's more popular, he's still the face.
So there's more pressure. There's more.
The pressure is there not to do anything interesting with him, which is why for years the most interesting stuff was the Elseworlds Superman stuff, or the self-contained. You know, the Secret Identities, your Red Suns, those are the interesting things because they could say it's not really Superman that this is happening to. You know what I mean? There's that separation between the character.
So, Connor, you read a bunch of the Superman in the 90s, right? The Death of Superman and all that. You were a regular reader at that time. So was I. Do you think that all those stories, like killing him, bringing him back, marrying him to Lois, all these different things that they did as sort of like a serial soap opera type of thing, didn't work for the character, or do you think they were just poorly written, but they could have worked?
They didn't. I think those particularly didn't work. Although as a kid, I was 13, I freaking loved Death Superman. You
know? Right.
It was awesome as a teenager, but as an adult, I have a different opinion on it. But I always didn't like the marriage for the same reason I didn't like the Spider-Man marriage. But
I think. I felt like, for me, those, like, I liked them at the time, but I didn't last with them for extremely long periods of time because I felt like over time, there wasn't so much you could do with Superman. And I think that's a tough thing. We talked about it on the Fuzzy Typewriter podcast when we were talking about the Man of Steel movie. And, you know, it really, to me, it struck me that what appeals to me most about Superman was the myth and almost how he's seen by other characters. And so I feel like short form stories often work best because they illustrate that sort of ideal of the character. That he is that thing we all want to be. And so that works best in like a short form. I don't know.
Here's what I think. I think that Superman is very similar to the Fantastic Four in that for years, the idea that it was the Fantastic Four are out of time. They weren't a modern conceit. You know, the modern audience would never accept them. They're too hokey, which is basically what most people say about Superman. It took Jonathan Hickman to say, no, the characters aren't the problem. It's just the stories are the problem. And so he told a great kick-ass Fantastic Four story in a modern way, but using the characters in a very true sense. And it was a very popular book, again, because, I think ultimately in the day it comes down to just telling good stories and not getting wrapped up in the worry about the myth or the weight of the icon or whether or not modern audiences will tell, modern audiences will respond to a good Superman story.
Yeah.
It's just that they don't get told for whatever million corporate reasons, I think. I gotta feel like that's gotta be it because... Good story is a good story.
I think origin stories for Superman especially are kind of the most common because I think in a way, like to what you're saying, they're the easiest to tell. It's easiest to get right or to take a new spin on it slightly or whatever. I think in the long run, yeah, you kind of have to keep throwing problems at your hero, but he's the hero that can sort of beat everything. And, you got to figure out how to, how to make that all work. And if you have, if you attack his friends and family and stuff like that, or attack him in a way where he can't really, punch his way out of it, maybe people that isn't satisfying enough. I don't know. I think it's a tricky thing. He's a tricky character to do.
But. I think they hang things on him that are just superficial. We'll make him a blogger now. That'll make people relate to him. And it's like, no,
right.
just tell a good Superman story. All-Star Superman... It was a great Superman story. They didn't change anything. They didn't alter the mythos to make him more modern or hip. They just told a good Superman story. And I think that's been the biggest problem.
And I think, talking about the idea that you can't put him into situations that are too modern. It's with the Jeff Parker and Chris Somney story, I mean, he's dealing with a heroin junkie who's getting particularly manic and it's, giving him superpowers. It's the modern world, and it's a modern conceit. But he's not dealing with a guy who's an apple pie junkie or something.
Right.
But then Superman himself, he embodies the virtues that of Superman. And I think when the question came up, can you do a Superman movie that's like PG-13? Is that too much? I think you can do a Superman movie that's PG-13, as long as Superman's goal is to. Make help the world be a little bit more G or PG from that PG-13. It's like he's working towards that, and if everyone else is working more towards an R, that's okay as long as Superman is headed in that other direction.
At one point, 10 million people watch Smallville a week, so clearly it's not the idea that the audience isn't he's not modern enough for the audience.
Yeah.
It's just that you have to tell a story that people respond to, and people are responding to the movie. So, you can tell
That's
whether
true.
Or not you agree it's a good story or not. People are responding to it. I just think that the quality of the story is really Superman's problem and not the character.
Yeah, and I like that we're talking about Superman. I like that that's a big conversation, and it's very clear that people take it very personally, and that's another reason why it might be hard to write a Superman story, because we each have a maybe different idea of what Superman is. It's not we're all just saying. There's not just a bunch of us that are like, I want the, the Richard Donner Superman. I want that. It's or even the George Reeve or the Christopher Reeves, Superman. Like, it's not that. It's we each have a different idea of what those things represent.
I think more so than any other superhero, he is a cultural icon. And that means people take it very personally. Not even Batman. People don't even take Batman as personally as they take Superman. For whatever reason. Maybe it's just because of the way he represents, but... Batman's more popular, but I think Superman is more personal for some reason. So there you go. Let's do one more quick one. Where did I lose my place? Oh, here we go. James, also from Parts Unknown, says, my wife and I are expecting our first child in December. As we are going through names for the child, I am constantly thinking of which superhero any given name relates to. What are your thoughts on specifically naming a child after a fictional superhero or specifically avoiding a name because of said superhero? Or should I just buck convention altogether and name the child Goat Pervader after the original drummer in the awesome black metal band Gorgoroth? Definitely do that.
Yeah.
Do that. Yeah.
I think you guys kind of answered this in your secret identity conversation, right? About naming your kid Clark Kent.
Yeah, don't name your kid Clark Kent. That's, you know, don't do that. I don't know.
My rule for children's names are always, what does it rhyme with, and can they make fun of you for it?
Well, Dave, you have a son. What did you name him?
My son is named Jack, and
named him after Jack Bauer.
I am a big fan of the Jack Knight Starman, and so occasionally people will wonder if it, you know, who's named after that. A little bit. His full name is Jackson, and so a lot went into that name. But I would be. I'd have to admit to you guys that maybe a little bit of my love of like characters named Jack, like Jack Knight. This was before Jack Bauer.
Well, Jack's
so I
a good name. Jack's like a good. Yeah, solid.
Jack's a good name, and it can mean different things. And it's like yeah. I think you know, don't name your kid Kal-El, you know, because that's like a very specific thing.
Superman, you know, that it could Cal, only right? be that.
Like I secretly,
but
will
Nick Cage
know
named
a
his
Jack
son
Knight
Kal-El. That's a thing yeah, that actually yeah. happened.
Yeah.
So.
On the other hand, you have Josh, who did not name his son after Green Arrow, yet did name his son after Green Arrow, and I don't know how he didn't see that coming. But
it's a great name. It's a
great name. I'm just saying.
I really love that name.
If he wasn't a member of iFanboy, it probably wouldn't have been an issue.
You might want to give it a second check because yeah, people are going right. to assume. Why did he name his son
this
after
is
Green
the thing.
Arrow? That's weird. He doesn't even like Green Arrow.
It's like, you know, pick a name. You know, first off, pick, you know, whatever name you know you want. Like, you know, it's your kid, but. Consider the fact that, you know, there's certain names that are like a brand on the kid's forehead. And then there are other names that are sort of like, you know, and that's okay that just you know how special that is. Like, and you can talk about that if you want.
Paul's a good name. Paul's a good solid name.
Are there any superheroes with a...
My name means small man from the big mountain.
But you're a very tall man, though.
I'm just 6 foot. I'm
not. All I know is that if I name my next child Katar, it's not going to be any different than some of the other names in the preschools right now. That's all I'm saying.
That's true.
You can email us at contact@ifanboy.com or call our voicemail line at 888-FANBOYS 326-2697. Tell us your name and tell us where you're from and give us a good question. We'll keep the voicemails around 30 seconds and hopefully you can get a good question on the show. Let's talk about some other shows we've got going on. As Paul mentioned, we saw Man of Steel. All of us all had very different reactions to it. We did a Man of Steel podcast, me and Josh Flanagan and Mike Romo talking about the movie. I think that from talking to them individually, our opinions have changed slightly since we've recorded the show. In some cases,
it was a good show, though.
It was a very good show.
It was a very good show.
And you talked about some things I hadn't considered, but yeah, I got a very sad email from Mike Romo.
After seeing it again with him later that evening and having a long discussion in the lobby of the theater at about 2 in the morning, they were trying to usher us out onto Sunset Boulevard. We had some alterations, but it's mostly the same, but with some caveats. So that if you saw Man of Steel, and as everyone seems to have, and you have some thoughts on it, or you want to hear some more thoughts on it, listen to the special edition podcast on Man of Steel.
It's a great time to jump in also on the Man of Steel spoiler-free review, because there's only 500 comments under there. It's fine. You can just wade right in.
Also, you can hear Paul and Dave talk about it. And where can you hear
Yeah,
that?
We did our Fuzzy Typewriter show. We took a little break. We've been talking about the Rocky movies because I hadn't seen them before. So we've been working our way through those. Just a slight intermission to talk, because we've got to talk about Man of Steel. So The episode is called Superman, Man of Steel. It's over on you can just type in fuzzytypewriter.com.
It's
4 hours
long, that show?
It's but the
it's
thing
longer
is
than
it's
the
not
movie.
Just about Man of Steel. We talk about Superman in general in all different media. You talk about some of the movies, we talk about the comics, and we don't talk about the radio show as much as I would have liked, but we talk about Superman and what it means to us, and Dave had a special hairbrush. And then I've actually heard from other people who have that hairbrush, and that brought up great memories for them.
Really?
We'll talk about that later. We talk about Superman and Man of Steel for 2 hours and like 44 minutes. So you can listen to a little bit of it on the bus, you know, on your commute. It'll take you through a week. So I hope you dig that.
Let's keep talking about Superman.
Let's keep talking about that. We are going to, because we got a Booksplode. We're going to be talking about Superman Birthright by Mark Waid. And Lanil Francis Yu, which is one of the origin stories of Superman.
And one of the sort of minor influences in the film. You can definitely see it in there when you read the book. So me and Paul and Mike Romo will be talking about that book, and that'll be coming at you sometime this week.
Yeah.
In the meantime, go to iFanboy.com. You can read Paul's Pick of the Week review, and you can read, is it still my Book of the Month up there? My Book of the Month review, as well as all the great discussion topics, columns, news stories, everything that's happening in comics is happening at iFanboy.com. And you can go to fanboy.com/about to see the social network pages for all the staff members. You can be our friend online and follow all the action at twitter.com/iFanboy and facebook.com/iFanboy.
And you can email us at contact@ifanboy.com and leave a voicemail, or leave a voicemail at 1-888-FANBOYS, that's 326-2697, with any questions, comments, concerns, discussion topics, baby names, or Saturnalia gift-giving suggestions.
What is that?
When is look that up, Dave. Look that up.
It's like an ancient Roman festival.
Yeah, that sounds
around.
Right.
It's like around Christmas. You know, might have influenced Christmas or something. So
that's a Doctor Who thing. If you dig us, write us a review in iTunes, or better yet, tell your friends about us. Introduce your mom to the podcast. Spread the iFanboy word. And that is it for this week's show.
Thank you, Dave, for stopping by. We really appreciate it. We had fun.
Thanks so much, man. This has been great.
And if Josh doesn't really come back, which he might not.
He joined a biker gang,
and he might just never come back. So hopefully we'll see by next week. We'll find out if Josh has returned. Until then, I'm Connor.
I'm Paul.
And I'm Dave.